Cynthia's the executive director of the Americans for Nonsmokers' Rights, ANR, and its sister organization, the ANR Foundation.
Thank you very much. Now that Jennifer's leaving, I can say what I want. No, I'm kidding. Bye, Jen. Safe travels. all kidding aside, thank you for the opportunity. It has been a wonderful opportunity to be able to collaborate with the Public Health Law Research group at Temple University and also at RWJ and elsewhere. I am the executive director of the American Non-Smokers Rights Foundation, as well as Americans for Non-Smokers Rights. We have both a C3 and a C4. But the ANR Foundation, since about 1980, started collecting all of the local tobacco-related laws. And so we started this data set a long time ago, just very specifically on smoke-free, local excise tax, youth access laws, and so on. And we had always thought and hoped that the passage of these eventually 100% smoke-free laws would lead to positive health outcomes, but really it was this partnership and working with other researchers and looking deeper at these laws that we have collaboratively created a very rich resource, data resource, to demonstrate that, yes, there is an immediate and a long-term public health benefit to smoke-free laws. So part of the presentation today is really talking about how do we translate from research to public health law. Again, while my background, I have an MPH from UCLA School of Public Health, and I did research and evaluation, my heart is in advocacy, and I really enjoy doing that, and so I like reaching out to the research community to be able to do these things. Oh, and by the way, I have no conflicts of interest to disclose, and neither does Jennifer. So the overview for the presentation that Jennifer and I were going to kind of tag team is really trying to think about a framework for translation and dissemination of all this wonderful research that's being done, thinking about key strategies for making an impact with individual research studies, and then how we can take some of this information to further our public health law goals. And I'm going to give some examples a little bit later about how smoke-free, I mean, Jennifer described how we went from, you know, sections to now we're 100% smoke-free in all workplaces at all time. How did we get there? How did we keep making those policy leaps and strengthening that model? And then again, examples of how to inform policymaking. So this is sort of a work in progress, but it is a framework, if you will, for thinking about translation and dissemination. How do we go from the practice-based learning, all of the elements for needs assessment, knowledge creation, etc. Oh, cool. Hello. Nobody wants to. Oh, there it is. And again, building capacity both for practitioners, researchers, and policymakers, and then the evidence-informed practice. So anyway, that's sort of a work in progress, and I know that Jennifer was talking about how we want to work on that. This is just, I'm going to shout. So strategies for making an impact, making connections. You know, we frequently talk in public health about how we kind of silo ourselves off, and when we think about that, typically it's by issue of interest. You know, I'm tobacco, and even though I'm in alcohol, tobacco, and other drug section, you know, I'm tobacco, and she's alcohol, and he does other drugs. But, you know, we really need to... Only for fun, once in a while. No, I'm kidding. I believe this isn't being recorded. But really trying to look at, you know, how we're going to collaborate. And so knowing our audience, not just from the practitioner to the field, but even within public health, how we can communicate with one another. Developing these research questions every now and then and again. You know, I would pull Jen over at the last January public health law meeting that they were having and saying, you know, I'd really like to be able to design a study that I would need to collaborate with someone on to look at the health of casino workers in states that require casinos to be smoke-free, in states that don't have any smoke-free laws, and then in New Jersey where the law is partial. To really be able to look at, you know, do these laws actually protect health the way we think they do? And we have enough states now. There are 20 states that require all of the state commercial casinos to be 100% smoke-free that I think we could design a study. And if some brilliant researcher wants to work on that, let's talk and we'll submit a proposal. Again, so developing these research questions, building the evidence, and then taking that evidence and translating it so that it gets to the field. And I'm going to share some examples there. A lot of great studies that have been published, but then how do we use them? And actually, I'll give one example. There was one recently done, again, talking about casinos, reminded me of it. In Colorado, they had phased in a smoke-free workplace law for workplace restaurants, bars. 1 year later, they made their casinos 100% smoke-free. There happens to be a single ambulance company that services the casinos in the casino towns of Black Hawk and the neighboring city, which I'm forgetting. So we had, again, this sort of perfect study where we could see, did calls for ambulances to the casinos decrease once the casinos went smoke-free? And the Reader's Digest version of the story is yes. When Colorado's workplaces, restaurants, and bars went smoke-free, calls to those types of establishments went down by 20%. When the casinos went smoke-free a year later, calls to ambulances to workplace restaurants and bars remained the same because nothing had changed. Calls to casinos went down by 19.3%. So, I mean, no more research needs to be done, but the initial findings are, if you go smoke-free, the need for an ambulance is reduced. Is it just because of the smoke-free? We don't know. You know, women go into labor early and maybe they're in a casino gambling. I don't know. There could be other factors. We don't know why the casinos were called there, but it's a very interesting finding, and of course, I think that should lead to more research. So very quickly, again, I think for public health, there's this question of maybe being worried about law. There's also the question about advocacy versus education. And I think probably everybody in this room, especially if you are lawyers or have any sort of legal background, know that there is a difference between advocacy and advocacy being just one form of lobbying. A lot of times, and in many, many grants, particularly federal grants, and I won't name the one organization right now, but it's like we certainly cannot engage in lobbying, but we're not even allowed to use the A word of advocacy. But advocacy is just sort of this broad term covering a range of activities that seeks to bring about systemic social change. And just one form of advocacy can be lobbying, but there is other form of advocacy. And education, we can educate the heck out of anything, sharing facts, figures, stories on an issue. And as long as there is not a bill for certain, whatever your argument is, would not be viewed as lobbying. But communication of public support or demand, certainly not direct lobbying, especially, again, if there's no bill pending. So just sort of a public service announcement. So one of the things that have come up, and it came up at the Public Health Law Conference, was an example of somebody's institution would not allow them to share with the press the findings of their study. They just felt it was great research, but it was a little too controversial, and so they were basically muzzled and told, you can't go to the press with this. And they were frustrated because they had this wonderful research and they didn't know what to do with it. And so I raised my hand and said, did you ask any other partners in the field who might be able to do that? Some other advocacy organization, another volunteer organization, heart, lung, cancer, if it's tobacco control or the food and nutrition issues, just some other group who might be able to help disseminate that for you. So I think we need to think about how your work can then go into other people's hands so that then we can tell ANR members or other partners at health departments or their coalitions, how they can put this evidence into a letter to the editor, to insert it into the testimony that they can provide at public hearings, how they can generate some other earned media. We're working with folks right now about writing op-ed pieces, putting it into their tweets and on their Facebook, et cetera. But really just being able to find ways to integrate these findings into coalition and public health agency educational materials and fact sheets. So again, moving from sections to smoke-free, really the bottom line is this sort of footnote that I put on this slide, that the changes from the 70s and 80s to like sections, and then in the 90s we had clean indoor air laws, but there was still this sort of negotiation about, well, maybe separately enclosed, separately ventilated is okay. And then there was research that was conducted that said, no, you know what, there's leakage and seepage of the secondhand smoke, even with ventilation. So that gave us, as an advocacy organization, the research base to go forward to strengthen our model for what we thought was then the best law, which is 100% smoke-free in all places at all times. Now, at the time, who knew that was also going to include casinos? Casino expansion started happening rapidly over the last 6 years as states are looking to close budget gaps. And I think public health is having a hard time making the leap that casinos are workplaces, but they employ thousands of people, and so we are advocating for that. hence the question about doing the research in casinos. But these shifts toward these stronger laws were both based on public demand, because once we had the sections and the smoke would drift, people were like, this doesn't make any sense, and the science. And if we didn't have the backing of the research that documented the health effects and the ongoing exposure, we really would have been seen as the crazy Berkeley-based zealots trying to just be prohibitionists rather than saying, guess what? We actually have a public health hat. Yes, we're zealots and advocates for smoke-free, but we're justified in doing so. So again, just to quickly go through this because we're short on time, very little science in the 70s. Thank goodness at the time we worked on sections because it was just the right of the non-smoker to, at a minimum, have a smoke-free space. Then we had the Surgeon General's first report in the 80s, and we started to see more change, more public support as we were getting more research and science out into the field, and as communities and states were starting to successfully pass and implement smoke-free laws. And of course, the footnote here is then we started to see the preemptive language. The tobacco companies figured out they couldn't be in all the local jurisdictions, so they wanted to always do things at the state level where they had more power and political will because they were giving campaign contributions. But we started to see this preemptive language being introduced. And while once we finally recognized it as a movement, we were able to put a stop to it, but it took quite some time to repeal it. Again, in the 90s, we started to see airlines go smoke-free. We saw the EPA finally labeling what we call secondhand smoke, they called it ETS, as a Class A carcinogen. And it was the beginning of funded projects, like through Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, at a massive level with smokeless states, which again galvanized the public health professionals, created a broader movement, and gave us more research. So I'm going to quickly try to get through these last few things very, very quickly. Making a lot of progress. Local still leads the way in terms of passing smoke-free because of the state influence of the tobacco industry at the states. This is an example that Jennifer put in. So yes, see, look, I was even timing myself. About graduated licenses, and again, people feeling like, gosh, if we do this, we're going to be targeting young drivers for predators to identify them. And then there was some wonderful research done which actually documented that by putting the little tags on the bumpers and making sure that young drivers couldn't drive between certain hours late at night, that accidents went down and that there wasn't any of the other perceived negative effects about, you know, predators sort of identifying, hey, there's a teen, let's do whatever terrible thing. So how were these changes possible? Again, really needing to engage a broad base of people, so not just health professionals, but the general public and workers in these environments. I think we covered some of these things, so I apologize. I'm just going to go through them quickly. But I think, again, the last one, really trying to identify the right messenger or coming up with role delineation. You know, some of you are the experts in law, others are the researchers, and others of us are the advocates who have connections. We need to figure out how we work together and then decide who says what when. You know, if you're just about to go into a hearing and there's a bill, I can talk. I will be your mouthpiece. Let's decide what our messages are going to be. If it's to a scientific news service, you give the message, I'll tell you about the advocacy messages, and we'll work them in together. But together we can be a stronger team and I think accomplish our goals even more quickly. Thank you.